Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This message comes from OnPoint sponsor Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans, introducing Rate Shield approval. If you qualify and if rates go up, your rate stays the same. But if rates go down, your rate also drops. To learn more, go to rocketmortgage.com/OnPoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point.
Join us. Remember who you are. You belong with us. You are a planeswalker.
Planeswalkers, elvish druids, multi-headed beasts, sorcery, enchantments. We're talking about the card game Magic the Gathering, which turns 25 this year. Magic is a game of battling creatures such as the furtive homunculus or the sky swirl harrier. There's also surprise spells. It's been nicknamed Cardboard Crack, likened to a combination of chess and poker, and played by at least 30 million people around the world. And some say it's also a game that changed and continues to change the world of gaming in a profound way. But has it changed it enough? Is the world of Magic welcoming to all? This hour on Point, Magic the Gathering turns 25. You can join us on air or online. Do you play Magic the Gathering? What has the game meant to you over the years? Do you play for money, for a sense of community? How did Magic cast its spell over you? Join us at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And I should let you know that later this hour, we'll be taking a look at CBS chief Les Moonves. He is stepping down after more serious harassment allegations against him. There's also a major corporate battle at CBS ahead. We'll be taking a look at that much later this hour. But joining me first today to talk about Magic the Gathering is Nima Jeromi. He's an editorial staff member and contributing writer at The New Yorker. You can find a link to his story, The 25-Year Journey of Magic the Gathering. There's a link at our website, onpointradio.org. Nima, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. Also with us from Seattle is Tifa Robles, founder of the Lady Planeswalkers Society, an organization that works to bring women into the world of magic. She's a lifelong gamer and the former brand manager for Magic the Gathering. Tifa, welcome to On Point.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's great to have both of you. Okay, so a little bit later, we're going to be hearing from the head designer of Magic the Gathering. But first, full disclosure, and I hope this does not disqualify me from hosting this hour, I personally never played Magic. When I was in middle school and high school, I played a totally different role-playing game, a couple of years of playing Shadowrun, to be perfectly honest. But I'm a Magic newbie. So for the folks out there who are like me and not, you know, a member of the 30 million strong Magic fans, Nima and Tifa, can we just start with sort of a basic explanation of what Magic is? What is this card game, Nima?
I'll get it started, but I feel like Tifa probably knows a lot more than I do.
Okay, you're right to say that because Tifa actually worked at the company that created Magic, and she's founder of Lady Planeswalker Society. So Tifa, let me just start with you. Help all the Magic lay people out there. What is this card game and how do you play it?
Absolutely. So it's a trading card game, meaning that there's basically an endless amount of cards in the world that you can build decks from. As a player, you take on the role of a planeswalker, which you can think of as sort of a cool wizard. You have a deck of cards that has spells and creatures that you cast against your opponent. You use a resource called mana to cast these spells. The goal of the game is to get your opponent down to 0 from the health starting at 20 before your own health is at 0.
I see. So I have got some of the cards here, some Magic cards here that were very kindly lent to us by a colleague here at WBUR. And they're cool and delightful, I have to say. I'm looking at, and the artwork is beautiful on them, actually. I'm looking at one, I mentioned this a little earlier, called the Furtive Homunculus. And it's a creature. And you see the picture of the homunculus. And then there's a little sort of story language quote underneath it. And it says, "In terms of intelligence, homunculi are somewhere between humans and scabs, clever enough to follow more complex orders, but dim enough not to question them." And that's attributed to someone named Stitcher Mr. Giralf. So what? So is there, are there stories, Tifa, behind these characters, these creatures?
Yeah. So one of, I mean, one of the most amazing thing about magic and how it can appeal to all different types of people is that there is the art, right? Like some people really get into it because of the amazing art. There's flavor and stories that even go beyond the cards. You can find like deep story on the Wizards website that they post weekly stories on. And then there's even novels. And then the mechanics themselves in magic are also very unique and well thought out and designed and developed. So it's, there's a little bit of something for everybody in magic, and that's one of the things that I really like about it.
Yeah.
But yeah, the flavor, I mean, the lore is very deep.
And who's creating this lore, though? Is it the players, or is it, are the game designers? Where is it coming from?
Wizards of the Coast creates, like, they have a creative team that works for them that develops the story arcs. But from my experience in brand, everyone in the company is sort of involved with all the different aspects, but the creative team is who, you know, sort of owns that story portion.
Yeah. So, Nima Jeromi, let me turn back to you here, because the first Magic decks came out, what, in 1993 or thereabouts?
Yes.
And it seemed to me that, I mean, as you talked about in your New Yorker story, the key, one of the many key innovations here was that unlike role-playing games of old, Dungeons & Dragons being the heavyweight amongst them, like magic games can come to an end. As Tifa said, like you can actually win a game. And secondly, the cards themselves. So lots of different, they become collectible. So a lot of things coming together to really make this a new thing on the fantasy gaming world.
Well, yeah, and that's right. They do come to an end, but the funny thing about it is there's this thing that players refer to as the metagame. I'm hoping I'm not getting this wrong, but it's these decks. You know, the first edition of cards that came out there were around 300, but you only had around 60 or so in your deck, and so you're kind of compiling and building these decks. And back then, when they were kind of promoting it, they had this rule guide, and in it they talked about how the decks were supposed to be like characters, like in role-playing games in a way. And so the games end, but your ability to change up your deck and change the way the game is played is kind of endless. And they knew from the beginning that their intention was to keep putting out new editions of the games. They were going to go to different universes, parallel universes, all sorts of different, what they called planes, and explore them and create new storylines. And I feel like the interesting thing about the storylines is that, yes, the company makes them, but also there's kind of a story that's acted out while you're playing the game of how the battle went or just sort of which cards came out. And it's a thing that I think there are players who claim that they completely ignore the art and the story while they're playing, but there are some players who are just, it's really important them to have a deck that's going to come out with a lot of elves,
right,
or a lot of goblins or something like that. And I think one of the things that also makes it appealing is that there are these five colors, and each one has its own individual attributes. It's really a game about diversity in a way.
Yeah. Well, in your New Yorker story, you quote Richard Garfield, the inventor, the creator of Magic the Gathering. He says that magic is closer to role-playing, as you mentioned, than any other card or board game I know of. Each player's deck is like a character. We have some additional tape here from Garfield. He invented Magic the Gathering in 1993, and he says he has no idea it would become so successful.
I certainly didn't anticipate it in the sense that I'd seen many, many games before which were very good but were very small. So to see Magic blow up like that was gratifying and unexpected. And it still surprises me when I think about it today.
Tifa Robles, we have the advantage of hindsight here, but should he have been so surprised?
I don't think anybody could have expected the way that it blew up. I mean, it completely changed gaming.
How?
And so the amount of games that have sort of replicated the same idea, it's, I mean, more than I could even count, because I can think of at least five that are successful, and that doesn't count any that, you know, have tried and failed. And even other styles of board games, like deck building games that are sort of standalone. You buy a box and can build like a deck of cards that you play. Like, that's like a whole nother genre of gaming that might not have existed without Magic.
Okay. So can I just jump in here, because you're talking about the cards? I've again, they're really wonderful. I've got Goblin Free Runner in front of us. And it says creature, goblin, warrior, ally. Up in the corner, it has a number 3. And is that a red fire dot? What is that?
Yeah.
That's the cost of the resources.
Card.
Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Okay. Meaning what?
So you would need 1 red mana and 3 other mana of any color to cast that. And mana it's a type of card. They're called lands. And it's what you use to cast anything in your deck.
I see. And it says here that this creature can't be blocked except by 2 or more creatures. And there are old goblins and ambitious goblins, but very few old ambitious goblins. I've been reading that the cards themselves are so collectible that there's the Black Lotus, that an original Black Lotus from a 1993 deck sold on eBay a little earlier this month. This past summer for $87,000.
Yeah. Yeah. That is definitely the most sought after card.
And so, so is that part of the attraction too, but the collectibility here?
For some people, I would say so.
I mean,
Nima, go ahead.
I think that there is. Well, it's two ways, you know. I mean, there is a kind of secondary collector's market that where people are, sitting on these things as speculators and things like that. But there's also just a sort of more benign sense of collection in that you want to get the best cards so you can play the best game possible.
Yeah.
And they're not unrelated, but...
Well, when we come back, we're going to talk about the community that formed very quickly around Magic the Gathering and how that community has spread to 30 million players worldwide. And the questions of diversity, always an issue within gaming, and how Magic the Gathering has been trying to tackle that. Do you have a Black Lotus out there? Anyone? I'm Magna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
This message comes from On Point sponsor Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans, introducing their all-new Rate Shield approval. If you're in the market to buy a home, Quicken Loans will lock your rate for up to 90 days while you shop. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Rate Shield approval only valid on certain 30-year purchase transactions. Additional conditions or exclusions may apply based on Quicken Loans data in comparison to public data records. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, and MLSConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
What's unique about the human experience, and what do we all have in common? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on TED Radio Hour, we go on a journey through the big ideas, emotions, and discoveries that fill all of us with wonder. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about Magic the Gathering, the fantasy card game. It turns 25 this year, and there are 30 million players around the world who play it. We're talking about why it's such a popular game, how it changed gaming, and also what Magic is doing about that age-old question about diversity in gaming. Before the break, we were talking about how there's a particular Magic card, the Black Lotus, which is one of the rarest and most valuable in the some 18,000 Magic cards that are out there. And if you look on YouTube, you'll find a 2014 video of someone unpacking a deck of Magic cards, and he found something. And I mean, his joy, it's infectious. But here's what happens.
Holy bitch! That's a freaking Black Lotus! Holy God!
And he goes on and on. Maybe might have been the highlight of his week or month or year there. By the way, that YouTube video has had more than 6 million views. So there's also the question of the community that's formed around Magic. And this is from a 2014 documentary published by Magic the Gathering's YouTube page. And it explores a Magic club at Abington Friends School in Jenkintown, Pennsylvania. There, the mother of a then sophomore basketball player, Jimmy Carpenter, explained that kids of all types of ability find joy in playing Magic.
I like it too because it keeps the kid alive in him. I mean, there's so much that like matures kids before they need to be. Like, this is something that when I see him play, it's like he's 10 years old again. He's just really into it. And I think he interacts with a whole different set of kids. He's an athlete and really identifies an athlete as an athlete. Mm-hmm. But he's also really into this game, and some of the kids he meets there are not kids he would meet in that world. So I think it's a great way to kind of branch out that way, and just another great way to use his brain. I love that he's involved in it.
Yeah.
I'm joined today by Nima Jaromi, editorial staff member and contributing writer at The New Yorker. Nima wrote about the 25th anniversary of Magic for The New Yorker magazine. Tifa Robles also joins us. She's founder and organizer of the Lady Planeswalker Society. And joining us now from Seattle as well is Mark Rosewater. He's head designer for Magic the Gathering. Welcome to On Point, Mark.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So you've been with Magic and its parent company for years now. I mean, you know, in a nutshell, why would you say it's had such staying power for 25 years?
Well, one of the things I think that's really special about Magic is you, the game player, get to be a game designer. So one of the great ideas, when Richard first came up with the game, this idea of the game is bigger than the box. And what that means is when you sit down to play a game, when you play Monopoly, let's say, The first property Monopoly is going to be Mediterranean Avenue, and the last one's going to be Boardwalk. And everybody who plays a game, that's true. The same 40 properties are always the same. But with Magic, you get to pick what you play with. Your opponent picks what they play with. So it's always different. So every time you play, it's just a radically different game. There's exploration. There's all this ability for each player to sort of make it what they want it to be. And that's a really exciting thing, something that gaming hadn't quite done and that Richard introduced to the sort of the gaming world.
Yeah.
In a game where it's not a role-playing game. It's a strategy game, right? There's a winner. You sit down, you play. But the idea that you have so much input in what you do really was a very different idea for gaming.
Yeah. So I want to get right to a question that the entire world of gaming has always had to grapple with, and that is the diversity of the players and the games themselves. And I'm looking at Nima's reporting in The New Yorker, and Nima reminded us, Mark, that back in 2012, some two-thirds of the principal characters in the Magic's world were men. And that at that point in time, the company was saying, well, look, I think you said this, right, that the natural gender skew of the game leans towards men.
Yeah, I mean, I think what happened is from the very early days of Magic, going back all the way back to 1993, we always wanted to be a game that was for everybody. For example, we used he or she. Back in the time where just everybody used he, we made the choice to use he or she. We made a choice very early on to avoid. There's a lot of stereotypes in fantasy that are a bit sexist. We try to avoid those. But we had a lot to learn. I mean, I'll be honest that we were always trying to get better, and that one of the things about making the game is we iterate. We keep improving upon ourselves. And early on, I think we had the attitude of, well, what we wanted to do is show strong female characters, make sure that they exist in the game. And then eventually what we said is that's not enough. Mm-hmm. That it can't. Yes, we want to show strong female characters. We want the females to see themselves in the game. But we had to go beyond just showing representatives. It couldn't just be tokens. The idea of balance was important.
Yeah.
And so right now, when we make a world, 50% of the people in the world are female. Because in the real world, 50% are female. And so in all the art descriptions and all the building of our worlds, we say, you know what? It's very important that when you see our worlds, 50% of them actually represent the fact that half of them are female.
Yeah. So, Mark, if I can, let me just bring Nima Jaromi back into this conversation here. Because, Nima, you went, you visited some Magic competitive tournaments and stuff. I mean, are you seeing a reflection of the company's commitment to making the game itself more diverse? Are you seeing that in the players?
I mean, I think that if you go to a tournament, you will see that there there are, it's still predominantly white men. But what I asked a lot of people, you know, what's changed specifically? And you know, I think the numbers have budged, although there aren't any specific statistics out there. But what a lot of people told me was that they've just felt increasingly comfortable. And I think that that probably could shift the dial. There's a big potential for shifting the dial there because of the way that, you know, as Mark said, they got more proactive about inclusivity and representation and making sure that people all feel welcome to come to these events.
Yeah. Tifa Robles, I mean, you are founder and organizer of the Lady Planeswalker Society. I mean, do you see magic and the community around it as welcoming to all players?
So I think there's been great improvement in the last 5 to 10 years. I started playing about 8 years ago, and at the time, there were very few women in the local game stores that I was playing in. And I was one of many people who were part of sort of a movement within gaming to try to make it more equal for all. And I've noticed a huge difference now when I walk into a game store. You know, there are a lot more women and a lot more diversity in general. And I think there's been a lot contributing to that.
Mm. Well, Mark Rosewater, I wonder if we should also give a tip of the hat to Beverly Marshall Sailing. She's the company's executive editor, right, who's been with the company since the start. I mean, in Nima's reporting, it says that she's often overlooked as someone who really helped Magic get its high polish and its feel from the start.
Well, Beverly, she doesn't work at Wizards anymore, but
yeah,
she was the very first editor for the company and worked for a long time for Wizards. And I think when I talk a lot about how we were trying to avoid certain stereotypes and, like, from the very beginning of the game, just even in language of he or she, of saying or she, that was Beverly. That was very much was Beverly's influence. And that, yeah, she was someone who was the conscience of the game for a long, long time that really said, look, we are a force of good in the world. We need to step up. And, you know, we want Magic to be something that inspires everybody and makes people want to move in the right direction.
All right. Well, we are talking about Magic the Gathering, the fantasy card game that's celebrating its 25th anniversary this year with 30 million players worldwide. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. A lot of Magic players want to call in and talk to us, so let's hear from them. Sue is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Sue, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call.
You're most welcome. What do you want to share with us?
Wanted to share my experience with Magic the Gathering was actually my son Bradley's experience. Brad had started playing the game, I believe, around 2011, and when we were living in New York State, in Geneva, New York, he used to go to a place called Good Game, which was a game store. And he started playing this game with other guys there in this group. And so he started out with a deck of cards and then, you know, gradually just kept expanding. And he would show me all these cards he had. And I was a little concerned at first, you know, but then I realized, well, he's actually in a really interesting, doing a very interesting thing. And I saw him, his mood changing, like becoming happy and creative, and he was an artist. And I say was because, tragically, my son passed away 3 years ago in October. He was 24. He had epilepsy. And you wouldn't know what to talk to him, but he was extremely creative. He was also a musician. He had been in college and so on and working and all that. So he was independent, but this gave him socialization.
Yeah,
because he was ostracized because of his, you know, a disability,
mm-hmm.
For those who knew he had it, or some people who knew he had it.
Yeah.
And he came out of his shell, you know, and he loved art. He was an artist, and it gave him a measure of choices in his life.
Right.
In his world, he didn't have a lot of choices.
Sue,
you know,
I first of all, I'm so sorry to hear about your son's passing, but I'm really, really grateful that you shared his story with us. And actually, to that point about the socialization that Sue was talking about that the game offered her son, let's go to Andrew, who's calling from Richmond, Virginia. You're on the air, Andrew.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm trying not to cry in light of the last call.
Yeah.
I'm also a musician and a professor of pop culture and history at Longwood University. And thinking about my gaming life, I realized that, you know, my early experiences as a gamer were pretty formative in my current career teaching about debate and giving me the basic skills that I need in the real world. I think many would agree with me that Tolkien is J.R.R. Tolkien, the works of Tolkien, are sort of originating the idea of fantasy escapism. And I think one of the most important things that he did to the point about diversity is try to protect his fantasy world and make it a place for everybody by saying he cordially disliked allegory. But if you put it, well, I want to talk about a specific card that concerned a very early Magic card. I played it when I was 12. That said, these dwarves, when these dwarves block or are blocked by orcs, they get a bonus, right?
Yeah.
So we had this, as adolescents, this very intense discussion about, you know, so whenever they block, if they block anybody, they're defending their homeland, or is it just orcs? Are they just racist against orcs, basically?
Oh.
And so the discussion is like, yeah, they would defend their homeland with extreme prejudice, and then also if they fought orcs in the field, they would have a bonus. Right?
I see. So, so Andrew, if I may, so it sounds like what you're saying is that through the game, it triggered your ability to have discussions that maybe you wouldn't have otherwise at the age of 12, 13.
Right. So if you take, my point about Tolkien to bring that in is that for him, and he later revealed that the dwarves were an allegory for the Jews, for Jewish people. So at 12 years old, we were having this intense discussion about, you know, the role of race and ethos in defending your homeland versus just, you know, is it a purely racial issue or is it purely,
right.
or is it about, you know, defending your homeland?
Right. Well, Andrew, thank you so much for your call. Tifa Robles, let me turn back to you on that. You just heard a couple of callers talk to us about how the game provided a means of socialization or even engaging with topics they might not otherwise have. What's your thought about that?
I feel that those are very relatable stories to a number of people that I've met throughout the years and talked to about how Magic has shaped their lives, because this really is a game that changes lives. Like as strong of a statement as that is, I've just seen the evidence over and over again that it, you know, helps people hone skills of communication, even for like children. I mean, it can help teach math. The community itself can be very accepting of different types of people because it is a game that can appeal to outcasts. It's a way to find escapism and a community that you can relate to and understand just through these cards.
Right. Mark Rosewater, I mean, does it do that because it is still largely, not exclusively anymore, but largely a tabletop face-to-face game? And if so, how long does that kind of last? Because I'm seeing, you know, I'm reading here that Magic is kind of migrating to the digital world as well.
Well, I mean, one of the things that's interesting about Magic is like I was at, there's a game developers conference in San Francisco every year that it's one of the big conventions to talk about gaming. And I remember looking at the board that there was the top 30 games and it was 29 video games and Magic. And now Magic does have some digital versions, but the heart of Magic is very tabletop. And that one of the things that I think is a competitive advantage, one of the reasons that Magic has been thriving is that with all the screen time, with all the time people interacting, you know, with the screen, it's so nice to sit down against another human being and interact one-to-one or one-to-many with other people. And I think that that's one of the competitive advantages Magic has had, actually, is in a digital world that, you know, you still can sit down with another person.
Well, Nima Jerome, I mean, is that likely to last, though? Because in your New Yorker story, you do talk about how there are increasing, there's a whole digital world as well now. And I think you can play the game online as well.
I think it absolutely will last. What I was talking about in my article was the sort of high-level, very competitive Magic that's played at, you know, big prize money tournaments where they want it to become more of an e-sport and get people to be able to spectate, and it's hard to follow if you just, like, put a camera over the top of it. What was really interesting in my reporting, I read a lot of the early press about the game, and there were people saying how is anyone playing this card game? It's just a bunch of cardboard when there's Sega Genesis to play, which was a competitor to Super Nintendo at the time. And that's that was like a line in 1994, 1993. So, I mean, and computer games have only gotten more elaborate, and the game has continued to become more popular.
Well, so can I just jump in here? Because on that point, we actually have a listener who sent us a question on our website, someone calling themselves DXO. They say, how do the numbers stack up against the video gaming juggernaut? I mean, video games are a multi-billion dollar industry. How does Magic stack up against that?
I mean, Mark, do you know?
Yeah, well, I mean, like I said, of the top 30 games, we're in the top 30 games. I mean, we do have a digital component. I mean, if you want to play Magic Online, there's both Magic Online and Magic the Gathering Arena, which are both ways to play online. But the most popular way to play Magic is still tabletop, is still face-to-face.
Right.
I don't know all the numbers of all the different video games, but, I mean, we are one of the juggernauts of the gaming world, and we are a card game. And that is, while that sounds weird in 2018, it is very much the truth.
Well, you're listening to Mark Rosewater. He's head designer for Magic the Gathering. Also joining us today is Nima Jeromi, editorial staff member at The New Yorker, who's written about the 25th anniversary of Magic. And Tifa Robles is with us. She's founder and organizer of the Lady Planeswalker Society. We're going to get more calls from you when we come back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Planet Money tip number 17. Sometimes the most important things need a hype squad.
Corporate.
Income.
Tax.
Corporate income tax!
Planet Money, a podcast about the economy. A very enthusiastic podcast about the economy.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about the 25th anniversary of Magic the Gathering, the fantasy card game that now has, or at least for a long time, has had 30 million players around the world. And, you know, you really know that you've made an impact on the culture when you get mentioned in any number of pop culture mainstays, such as, how about this, from South Park, where we get a scene where some characters are playing Magic the Gathering.
All right, I'm going to play a fifth mana card. And then I'm going to attack with my Elder Beast.
Can Kenny block his Elder Beast?
Not with his Shapeshifter, it's already tapped.
I am attacking, but with a newly summoned Sparkghast who has Trample. 4 damage to your Planeswalker.
Oh!
Oh, South Park, playing Magic the Gathering. I'm joined today by Mark Rosewater. He's head designer for Magic the Gathering. Tifa Robles is also with us. She's founder and organizer of the Lady Planeswalkers Society. And Nima Jeromi, editorial staff member at The New Yorker, who's written about the 25th anniversary of Magic. And folks, I just want to get a couple calls in here because so many people want to say something. Nancy is calling from Orford, New Hampshire. You're on the air, Nancy.
Good day.
Hi. Do you have some experience playing Magic, or even deeper than that?
I have some experience playing it, but more than that, I used to work for Wizards of the Coast.
That's the company that created Magic the Gathering. You used to work there, so tell us about that.
Yes. Well, I worked under Beverly Marshall Sailing, doing editing of the cards, and then I worked under Kathy Ice, editing the books.
Okay, and so, I mean, so you were one of the women who worked at the company early on. You heard us in the previous segment talking about whether or not it's done a good enough job making the game and the culture around it welcoming for women. I mean, you were there in the early days. Was that indeed a goal, and do you think they've met the goal?
I think that it was a big goal of ours. He was right in saying that we were trying very hard to always have he, she. We deliberately put in cards that were female. In the books, the same thing. But we were always pushing against the culture of gaming, which was always very male-oriented at that time. Mostly younger men were playing. We were trying to get women playing. In fact, we would go out to local places with a deck of cards and just casually start playing a whole bunch of females.
Right.
In public.
Yeah. Nancy, thank you so much for your call. Nima, Mark, Tifa, who wants to jump in here? Because that was, we did not plan that. Nancy's just listening. She called in. What do you think?
I mean, that's a great story. I mean, I was really surprised because I didn't come in trying to report a story about diversity. I just thought, you know, like I played this game as a kid and I was like, wow, this phenomenon is kept going. And I was really, you know, interested by the longevity. And I kept asking people questions and I would always ask them, you know, almost perfunctorily until it wasn't perfunctory anymore, this question. It was really kind of amazing how many people were dedicated to this in the beginning. And one of the things that really struck me was Richard, who didn't even consider it like, you know, his main preoccupation. He just thought it would be a good thing as a matter of course, you know, and really encouraged Beverly and a lot of the other people at the company back then to pursue that. Was really hoping that when the game came out, that there would be kind of a lot more women playing, yeah. and it didn't happen. And he was kind of disappointed. And he said, "Well, you know, we only made one game, but that's an amazing story that they went out and they were so dedicated to representation. They just put their bodies out there as women to as people playing the game, just so that people would know that, hey, this is a game that women
yeah.
can play too."
But let me jump in here because Tifa, let me turn back to you because I'm thinking about today though. I see that still when it comes to the giant world of competitive magic tournaments, that still relatively few of those top-level competitors are women. Is that right? And does that matter?
I absolutely think that it matters. And honestly, like right now, we're in a big culture shift that I think is making it easier. So I think 10, 20 years from now, there will be more women in that scene. But when the game started, I mean, gaming was a male-dominated field, and it's taken a long time for that to sort of shift. Like, gaming has had to become more mainstream for it to be acceptable for women to play games. Video games have helped with that because, you know, a lot of young girls that grew up with video games are now, you know, adult women, and they realize, oh, like, this is something that, you know, is acceptable for me to be involved with. But yeah, I mean, when I started playing, there were not a lot of women, and it was hard when looking at the pro scene. You know, I didn't see myself represented at all.
Mm-hmm.
But for a lot of women that I know, it's sort of pushed them to try to be better so that the next generation does have that to look up
yeah.
to.
You know, I'm seeing from Nima's story that Wizards of the Coast, the company that that owns Magic, is also trying to make people feel welcome at the tournaments by banning, they've even gone so far as to ban prominent players for harassment and bullying, especially if that happens online. Now, look, we could talk forever about this game. We've got 25 years worth of history to talk about. I've just got a minute left here. And so my final question for all three of you is a simple one. Or maybe it's a hard one. I don't know. The question is, what is your favorite card? Nima?
Oh, wow. I really should have prepared. I think I like the phantasmal. There was a phantasmal wall. It was like a glowing wall that just hung in space. I really enjoyed that one.
Okay. And Tifa Robles, your favorite card?
My answer is kind of silly, but it's Garrick's Companion because it's just back to the basics. It's a small green creature with trample.
Okay.
He's adorable.
So back to the basics, almost like a magic purist take there. And Mark Rosewater, your head designer, do you have a favorite card?
I do. My favorite card is called Doubling Season. It's a card that just doubles everything. It's a card I made really for myself, something I really wanted, and it's become a fan favorite that is just... People sort of love just exploding things and having tons and tons of things happen. And so that's my favorite.
Well, Mark Rosewater, head designer for Magic the Gathering at Wizards of the Coast, joining us from Seattle. Thank you so much for being with us today. And Nima Jeromi, editorial staff member and contributing writer at The New Yorker. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
And Tifa Robles, founder and organizer of the Lady Planeswalkers Society. It was great to talk with you, Tifa. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All right. And listeners, we know that huge Magic fans are out there. So go to our website, onpointradio.org, and tell us why you love the game. In a minute, Les Moonves is out at CBS. We'll take a look at the ramifications. This is On Point. Well, one of the most iconic leaders in television history, Les Moonves, is out as CEO of CBS. Yesterday, The New Yorker magazine published a second story detailing allegations that Moonves forced sexual acts on women and even retaliated against them as well. Now come many more questions about what the CBS board knew and what impact Moonves's ouster will have on the $20 billion company. Joining me now from New York is Bloomberg opinion columnist Tara LaChapelle. Tara, welcome to On Point.
Hi, thank you.
And also with us from Los Angeles is Kim Masters, editor-at-large for The Hollywood Reporter. Kim, welcome to you.
Thank you.
So first of all, it seems as if a lot has happened in the past couple of days. Give us what we know about Moonves's ouster. Have you been reporting that we're also seeing members of CBS's board on the way out as well?
That is a fait accompli. Several members of CBS's board were replaced yesterday. This is the Sherry Redstone, who is the daughter of the originator of this empire, Sumner Redstone, has basically put in place a board that is her board and gotten rid of the people who were loyal to, they were considered independent, but nonetheless were loyal to Leslie Moonves.
Okay. And Tara LaChapelle, this had to do, this matters a lot, obviously, for CBS itself, but also in terms of all that talk that was going on for a CBS-Viacom merger.
Absolutely. Redstone has wanted to have the companies explore recombining. Her father had split the companies back in 2006. And given that media companies are seeking more scale right now, trying to, you know, take on competitors on the tech side, such as Netflix and Amazon, it made sense to think about whether CBS and Viacom would be better together and maybe sell the combined company down the road. Les Moonves had fought that effort and didn't think it was in the best interest of shareholders or CBS, and the board was very much aligned with him on this. Now that he's out, there's a standstill agreement where Redstone can't push the companies to merge for at least a period of 2 years, but there is the question of whether the board, the new directors, could independently raise that idea again. There's also the possibility now that maybe CBS could get bought by a third party, another company out there.
Okay. So, Kim Masters, though, I mean, before we spend too much time talking about the future of this potential merger, we should note that, as far as we know, for now at least, Moonves is out with no severance package for as long as an internal investigation goes on. CBS says it's going to donate, what, $20 million to Time's Up and its sort of in its Me Too advocacy. Is that right?
Well, the company has put aside $120 million, which would have been a number that Moonves could have collected had he left in other circumstances. Now there is an investigation underway. It has been already since the initial story that Ronan Farrow ran in The New Yorker in late July. That's going to continue, and they'll determine whether he is entitled to any money or whether he would be essentially fired for cause and therefore entitled to nothing. But one way or the other, he and CBS have agreed that $20 million will go to Time's Up. They don't specify which causes, but Time's Up has a legal fund that is meant to defend women who are not necessarily Hollywood women, but women who are facing issues of discrimination
right.
and harassment.
But let me ask you, though, I mean, it seemed like a very large response from CBS. Now, it's a giant company, mind you, but doesn't it still continue to raise this question about what took the board so long to act? And if they are, taking these very concrete measures now, is there a sense that people within the company at the highest levels knew that this was going on?
I'm going to defer to Tara,
okay.
But I can answer that too.
Tara, go ahead first. Yeah.
Sure, yeah. I mean, I think there is that question because rumors about these allegations had surfaced nearly a year ago. It was sort of an open secret that a story was coming from Ronan. And, you know, if I were the board, that would seem like a time to start investigating and get ahead of it and look into whether these allegations are true and what they should do about it. Instead, they seem to be so focused on taking on Sherry Redstone and making sure that the CBS-Viacom merger didn't take place that I think they didn't really handle this situation the best they could for employees and for shareholders. And so there are a lot of questions now. I think, you know, this weekend brought a resolution to that, but it should be a lesson for other companies going through these things that you need to get ahead of it, and that in this day and age, you know, this Me Too moment is very serious for our culture, and you can't really just brush it aside.
Mm-hmm. And since Tara mentioned Ronan, that's Ronan Farrow, who reported these stories for The New Yorker. Some of the allegations do go back decades, but nevertheless, I mean, Kim Masters, do you want to chime in on your take on what this means about what CBS may have known or the behavior of the board?
Well, yes, there were rumors. I mean, because obviously you don't convict someone on the basis of rumors. None of the allegations is from, I'd say, all of them are more than 10 years old, and many of them go well beyond that. It seems to me, from what I can tell, that Les Moonves sort of changed his behavior in recent years. But, you know, these were violent attacks on some of these women, and obviously very unacceptable. Sherry Redstone had a couple of board members who were loyal to her before this shakeup, and they did, as I reported a while ago, request the board start to investigate Les. Now, you know, there was no action until Ronan published that first story in late July. So as Tara says, this does not reflect well on the board that was in place. But let me just say, you know, you have to realize the value. Despite the unacceptable conduct, Les Moonves is considered one of the greatest television programmers of all time. And therefore, CBS was really shooting the rapids at a time of really quick transformation of this business, and his value was very, very high. So that explains in part why the board wasn't just being stubborn, but was clinging to someone who they probably felt was, you know, essential to CBS's success.
Yeah, but on the other hand, I mean, this is the same network that had to deal with the fallout from the allegations surrounding Charlie Rose.
Yeah, I mean, they had a pervasive culture. I think it's clear. Oh, go ahead, Tara.
Oh, no, go ahead.
Well, it's clear there were pervasive cultures, especially in the news division. You know, Leslie Moonves had high-level women working for him. It seems like you either got the good version of Leslie Moonves, who was a supporter. That's why some women spoke out on his behalf when the first allegations arose. But then there was the bullying and, in the past, you know, sexually predatory Leslie Moonves. That was unacceptable.
Mm. Tara, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, you know, the 60-minute situation, they actually handled that very swiftly. And this is a problem that, you know, a lot of companies are dealing with, not just in the media world. It's not just CBS. I think in this case, you know, the reason it's gotten so much attention is because the way the board handled it. I mean, it took a really long time to get to this outcome. And, I mean, I remember just a couple weeks ago, we weren't even sure, you know, Les Moonves, we thought, could maybe even stay in the job, that there was a chance of that. So I think, you know, other companies have been commended for dealing with these things quickly, and I think CBS almost should have taken its own advice for how it handled, you know, the Charlie Rose situation.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just, it goes back to this ongoing lesson, Kim, as Kim was pointing out, that in this case, a CEO perceived as ultra high value because of how he was running the company. Maybe, I don't want to say got a pass, but that might have factored into the board's behavior around allegations surrounding Les Moonves. I mean, but Tara, we just got 30 seconds left here, though. Let me just ask you one more quick question. I mean, does CBS look ripe for acquisition now? It's a $21 billion company.
I think it does. I mean, it's tricky because a lot of the likely acquirers of maybe a year ago, such as Verizon, may be off the table now. Verizon isn't really looking for media bets, but that possibility is still out there. And, you know, it's never been a better time to try to swoop in since you don't have Les Moonves on the board fighting a deal at this point. I mean, I think that CBS would bring a lot of value to someone who wants content, and content is all the rage right now in deal making these days.
Yeah. Well, Tara LaChapelle, opinion columnist at Bloomberg. We have a link to her story about Les Moonves at onpointradio.org. Tara, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Kim Masters, editor at large of The Hollywood Reporter. Kim, thank you as well.
My pleasure.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.